بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Zaji Rahmatullah Ali had related this incident. The queen's dhobi is washerman. So the queen's dhobi, that is the washerman, she had been taking the clothing of the queen, the princess, doing a fine job. After some time, the prince's clothes was spotted by the washerwoman's son. He saw the clothing, and for some reason he took to the clothing. So he asked his mother, "Allow me to wash the clothing." It was the desire of the child, so the child took the clothing and he washed it. But he just took the clothing and he took a liking for it, and there was that additional finish, that extra finish on the clothing. Obviously, he took the clothing, and the clothing is the malboos of the labis. It is the cover of the person, right? So when you love the cover, you love the covered as well, right? You love the cover, then you love the covered. Love is initiated in different ways. Sometimes you see the clothing and you love the person. Sometimes you see the person and you love his clothing. See? Like how you have these brand names, right? Then you love the person, then you love their clothing. And sometimes you love their clothing, and because of their clothing you begin to like them. But how do you reconcile? How do you add it up? There's no logical way of adding it up. It's just that you like the person, so whatever he wears, then you begin to have a liking for that. And then that like is, that love is not ordinary love. That same t-shirt people will tell you, those that are doing business, they will tell you the same t-shirt without that brand name will be 50 rand. And with the t-shirt, you'll pay 500 rand. And people will go and buy that t-shirt for 500 rand. So what are they in love with? They are only in love with the name. So it's not the t-shirt, it's the name. So this love, and there's different approaches to love. How you initiate it, how you start it off. So this person fell in love with the clothing, and from the clothing it went to the person. So he will wash, and he will wash it with all care and all muhabbat and understanding, whatever. Give it that additional touch and thereafter send it. Now the mother been observing all this. She's getting afraid of the child as well. Okay, who's he in love with? He is a dhobi and he is dreaming of the princess. If they only get to know about it, they'll behead him. See, there is no resemblance. He's not of the same class. How can he ever think of that? How can he ever dream of that? They say once the hajam, the barber, he was doing the king's hair. So whilst he's doing the king's hair, then he's telling the king, you know, "Mera bhi larka hai aur teri bhi larki hai." You know, I have got a son and you have got a daughter, and you know, if they can get together. When the king heard this, his eyes popped out. His hajam, in India, in the eastern countries, unfortunately, the hajam is the most contemptible person. you know, like what you're doing, this, you get these beauticians and all now. So in India, in that zamana, up till now, it's the most contemptible job. But now it's a job of honor. What your wife is doing, she's a beautician. And here is a job of honor and praise. Things just turn around. When we were children, I can still vividly remember, you know, these jeans that people wear now. And the people that are most menial. In that time, you didn't have this the forklift and all that. They didn't have that forklift. So if the truck had to be offloaded, you do it by hand. So those boys that were doing that, that were offloading, they used to be wearing the jeans. And many a time they used to be torn at the knees. We used to feel sorry for them. Really sorry for them. And they used to be wearing jeans. If someone had a photo of them, they are wearing jeans and torn here. Right? And now that is a craze. You pay so much more for the torn jeans. So what was a beggar's clothes, now it becomes a king's clothes. Tilkal ayyamu nudawiluha bi'nnas. Allah Pak just changed things around. So when the king heard this, his eyes popped out. His eyes became red. Okay. He's a hajam, and he's thinking, dreaming of my daughter. Anyway, before he can take any procedures, he said, let me contact my wazir, minister, before I take any type of procedures. So the wazir told him, what you do? You just shift that barber's chair. See the room you have got it in. Remove it from that room, shift it to another room and see what happens. Now they shifted the chair and he's continuing the haircut. And he's not even entertaining the subject. The king is deliberately starting it off. You know, I got a daughter. And you know, how old is your son? And he's telling the king, but you mustn't speak like that. You must never speak of something like that. I'm not at all of your class. How can you ever speak of something like this? Anyway, so they put the chair again on the original place. When they put the chair in the original place, again he began to sing the same song. Mera bhi larka hai aur teri bhi larki hai, you know, kya achha hota ke wo dono saath ho jate. So the wazir said, you know what you do? You just dig under this place here, under this place where you are giving him that haircut, or where he's giving you the haircut, just dig it up. So they dug the place and they found a huge treasure of wealth. In the old days, they didn't have these banks and all this. So whatever wealth they would have, they would sink it into the ground, right? They would bury it into the ground. That was the safest place. So what I'm getting at is that this muhabbat and this love comes in different ways. Sometimes it is one aspect in that person that you like, and it starts off at that point. From that point, then it grows, and then that one sahabi, mistakenly he broke his roza, you know, in the month of Ramadan, and he said, halaktu, mein to halak ho gaya. So what happened? He says, no, in the moonlight, I just saw her heels, his wife's heel. And then he did what he was supposed to do in the state of Roza. In the state of Roza, what he's supposed to refrain from, he went and did that. So, what I'm showing you is that where it starts from a small point, from that one point it started off and then it goes up right top. Right. So the masla in that is that sometimes prohibitions come. And the prohibition that comes, they class it as saddan lil bab. That we are asking not to do this. Why are we asking not to do it? Just to close the doors. Because if you're going to open this, then you won't know your limits. Right? You won't know your limits, so we're just closing the doors. Right? So this is called saddan lil bab. Though, in essence, it may be permissible. But you know, this is not right for you. Right? Like sometimes, towards the evening, and we won't allow children to eat sweets, right? And then they say it will cause tooth decay, whatever else, right? But in essence, that sweet is permissible. If the child takes all the precaution, he brushes his teeth, take the floss, take out all that stuff from the teeth, then the chances for the teeth decaying is very less, right? But who's going to take all those precautions? So they say the easy way is ask him not to eat the sweet. So it won't bring about the tooth decay. Right? But is that sweet impermissible? Is it haram? Is it prohibited? It's not prohibited. But starting that will end up at this point. So this law is used in Islam. It's used in worldly matters as well. Like they ask you that you drive at a certain limit. You don't exceed the limit, right? Now, from other drivers, you may be a very professional driver, very good driver. That you know how to drive, how to maneuver the motor car. You know, it's very unlikely that you will get involved in an accident. But the law will apply to you as well. Okay, you also will adhere to the traffic requirements, speed limits. You will also. Why? Because you see again, saddan lil abwab. That if you want to start this off, that there's not going to be any control. Right? So in every facet of life, this law is used. And you start off at a very insignificant point, and then you come up at a point where you can't manage. See? One of the reasons why I advise that masail, you know, when you ask whether there's a Q&A session, the Q&A session shouldn't be over the radio, shouldn't be over the air. One-to-one, or if it is a question of a general nature is not specific to one person, or specific to something, then you give it over the air, it's alright. Like you say, alright, Zuhar namaz has got 4 rakats. So there's no differences of opinion. It's one problem and the same problem across the board. Everybody does the same thing. But otherwise, Q&A shouldn't be over the radio. Because there is a great chance of misconstruing the whole thing. Now look at a situation. One person comes up and he asks whether it is Ibn Abbas radiallahu anhu or someone else. He asks, that is there any forgiveness for murder? So Ibn Abbas says, Allah Ta'ala will definitely forgive you. The person who killed 99 people, 100 people, Allah Ta'ala forgave him, so Allah Ta'ala will forgive you as well. Then the second person comes and he asks the same question, is there any forgiveness for murder? He says, no forgiveness for murder, you will go Jahannam straight, you will roast and toast there all the time, perpetually. Now the students are asking, the one person you gave one answer that Allah Pak will forgive you, and the second person you're telling him that there is no forgiveness, forget it. You will toast and roast in Jannah perpetually. So Ibn Abbas says, afsos ki baat hai, it's a sorrowful thing that you people don't see what I am seeing. See, the first person, he's already committed murder. Now he's gone into a state of depression. And Islam doesn't entertain depression. We will show him that there is room for him as well. If he asks forgiveness, he follows the procedure, whatever. So there is room for forgiveness for that person as well, even though he's committed a very heinous crime. And the second person, he is still contemplating on murder. He is contemplating to murder someone. When he's contemplating to murder someone, I'm not going to tell him, go, Allah will forgive 99%, one person killed 99 people and he was forgiven, so Allah will forgive you also. Then I'll be giving him all the tools to go and do that wrong. Now, if this type of question and answer is given over the radio, will it cause confusion or not? It will cause confusion. So sometimes you get a question and answer that is of a general nature. Just everybody is affected. Everybody, the whole world is affected. Like, what is the length of the beard? You say, one first, right? That's the length of the beard. So that pertains, it relates to every Muslim. There you don't have to worry about it, because it relates to every person. Every person it relates to. But then there are some maslas that are particular. You know, like this I showed you, this murder question, forgiveness of murder. So it relates to one particular person. When it relates to one particular person, then you just have to answer him and end the story. Many a times they come up stories about a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law story, right? Now, it may be specific to one home, but now, as a result of them bringing it up in the air, right? Now, there is so much of panic in the girl's heart. The girl is not married, then there is so much of panic. So much of preconceived ideas, you know, to live with the mother-in-law. And, you know, the mother-in-laws give hell. So how am I going to live? So she gets into a panic. She gets into an anxiety unnecessarily. Why did she go into an anxiety? Because of the information that filtered to her. Through what? Through the air. Now, it may not be that every mother-in-law is the same. Then again, you look at the majority. Majority, you go and look. They can't afford to go and live separately immediately. They can't. Look at the majority of people. We're looking at ourselves, we got the means to make separate accommodation, right? But majority, do they have the means to do it? They don't have to do it. They can't. They have to stay 5 years, 6 years with their parents, etc. Gradually they will find their feet and they will carry on, continue with life. So what are we telling them? We're telling them, you must remain in sin, it's alright. Then afterwards, when you got enough money and all that, then you can leave the sin and get married. That's what we are telling them. Indirectly, this is what we're telling them. So we are actually encouraging the whole machinery of zina. One person comes and asks, Hazrat Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, that in the state of Roza, is it permissible to kiss the wife? No. Told him, permissible? You is permissible. No problem. Second person comes and asks, so not permissible. You mustn't do it. Now, people are wondering why. The first person, he was given the permission. The second person, no permission is given. So the Sahaba Kiram went to investigate those things. Now, what happened here? Here, he was given permission. Here, no permission was given. So in my own words, I say the answer. Okay, the first person was 90 years, and the second person was 19, you see. So at the age of 90 now, there's nothing left in him. You know, Ali Khan from Marisburg, a very jolly person, I was explaining this. So he's telling me, you know, when you say there's nothing left in him, he says, when the spouses, they reach about 60, then they are like brothers and sisters. And when they're 70 and above, then they're like two sisters. So there's nothing left after that. Now everything is finished. Everything is punctured. Batteries are all flat. I can't do anything now. Right? So Nabi Sassam gave the permission at that age. He's old, advanced. He won't be tempted. Otherwise, you go and initiate the process, right? You go and initiate it. You say, Saddan lil Bab. Person is newly married, 2-3 years in the marriage, he's young. He starts one thing, and then from one thing, then the second thing, and the third thing, and then eventually he does what he's not supposed to be doing. So we tell that young person, you don't start it off. Because he can't control himself. His mind and his emotions will have the better over him. So that's a mustaqil, a chapter on its own. Saddan lil abwab is a chapter on its own. In principle, the looking of the face of a woman is permissible. In principle. But all the ulama of all the four mazhab says it's impermissible. All ulama from all the four mazhab, they say that looking at the face of a woman is impermissible. Because the face is majma'ul husn. The face is the center of the attraction. Where's the center of the attraction in a woman? It's the face. You will hear youngsters talking, you know, hey, she's wearing that abaya. I wonder how her face must be looking. How she was looking from within, you know. So youngsters, they talk like that. Hey, she's walking like this, and she's like this, but how her face is looking. So, that face is the starting point, and from there it carries on. You begin to analyze, oh, the face like this, so this is how the body should be, etc. If the walk is like that, so you begin to make your own analysis, own qiyas, you carry on. Right? So they say, no, just stop the whole thing, just cut it off, don't even look at the face. Right? You see how the Shariat works. Just cut it off. Don't even look at the face. Because you'll start off from that point, then you'll carry on. One to the other, and to the third, and so forth and so on. In fact, the Quran Sharif says, one is the Quran Sharif says that, say to the believing men to lower their glances, lower the sight. Then say to the believing woman, they must also lower their glances, right? So if you're lowering your glances, you can't see the face. Then at the end of that verse, then the Quran Sharif says, وَلَا يَدْرِبْنَ بِأَرْجُلِهِنَّ لِيُعْلَمَ مَا يُخْفِينَ مِنْ زِينَتِهِنَّ. That when these women are walking, then ask them not to strike their feet. Why shouldn't they strike their feet? That some of the concealed beauty can be exposed if they strike their feet. One is the concealed beauty of that age. The concealed beauty of that age was anklets. Like how we wear churis, bracelets. Then in the eastern countries they used to wear anklets. Something in the ankles, right? Like how you wear bracelets here, then they wear anklets down. Now if they're striking their feet, then it will have a buzzing sound, right? So that will catch attraction. So don't you wear that, don't you strike your feet when you're walking. So one is the concealed beauty of those days, and one is the concealed beauty of this days. Now you ask the normal person, if a woman is walking with a high heel shoe or something, right? And she's tapping, cut, cut, cut. Do you feel anything in your heart or not? Ask the normal person, does he feel anything in his heart? The normal take is he feels something. Something. Although it's just the stamping of her feet. But he feels something in her heart. In his heart. So because these are the avenues that start off. The start of that crime. Quran says, no, don't attempt this. Don't even go near this. But then, Islam made that a permanent law. See, Islam made that a law. That the avenues to the wrong will also be wrong. The avenues that will lead to a wrong will also be wrong and haram. Like, look at it. The consuming of wine is haram, right? Why? Because you intoxicate. And why, then why? Is it impermissible? Because when you are intoxicated, then you will behave like a beast, right? In short, you'll behave like how you're not supposed to be behaving. You'll do what you're not supposed to be doing. So Islam said, no, you don't take this thing. But the actual thing that Islam prohibited was the consuming of the wine. But then the hadith says that squeezing of wine, selling of wine, transporting of wine, pouring of wine, serving of wine, all these people are cursed and equal as the drinker. One is the drinker, and what is all these people that come in the line? They all cursed. So why did the Quran Sharif have to curse all these people here? Why? Because they are the avenues to the ultimate. The ultimate is the consumption, but this is the avenue. This leads up to the ultimate. So if that is impermissible, then all this also is impermissible. Although that person that was selling, he wasn't getting intoxicated, he wasn't affected in any way. No ways he was affected, but the hadith will say, no, you also, you are cursed. It's not allowed for you. So all those avenues that will lead to the ultimate, you know, then you'll say all those avenues also are haram. Like that is haram, and all these avenues that will lead to that haram will also be haram. Now why did Islam have to say that? Islam had to say that because Rasulullah was unlike the Anbiya of the past. كُلَّمَا هَلَكَ نَبِيٌ خَلَفَهُ نَبِيٌ. Before Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, if one Nabi passed away, then there was another Nabi that was replacing him. Some Nabi is coming after him, and the work is carrying on. So, people are getting guidance all the time. But وَلَا نَبِيَّ بَعْدِي. After Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, there is no Nabi to come. No new Nabi to come after Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. When there is no Nabi, no new Nabi to come after Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, now, we need to nip the avenues in the bud as well. Because if a wrong comes in, then who's going to come and rectify it? There's nobody coming to rectify it because previously a Nabi was coming. So a wrong set in, there was another Nabi coming in and correcting it. But now there's no Nabi to come. When there's no Nabi to come, a wrong sets in. Now who's going to come and correct it? I ask you, who's going to come and correct it? There's no Nabi. An alim doesn't have the actual maqam and the position of a Nabi. If a Nabi says something, it becomes law. An alim doesn't have the position. Here, the consensus of the ulama, all the ulama internationally, if they have consensus, then it is a decision in the Sharia. But an alim doesn't have the same position. So now, who's going to take care of the Sharia? By the same token, right, if Islam said, for example, idolatry is impermissible. Right? Idolatry is impermissible. Idol worship is impermissible. Then the avenues that will lead to idolatry, all will be impermissible. Right? It may not be exactly idolatry, but it's those avenues that had and will ultimately lead towards idol worship. It will lead to shirk. It will lead to polytheism. You know, ban all those issues. So, hence, from that point onwards, Rasulullah said, oh, photography, haram. Because, what happened, how this whole polytheism, how it started off, if you look at the tarikh and the history, it started off in the same way, that a pious person, la yahusa wa ya'uqa wa nasra, a pious person passed away. For his remembrance sake, people created an image, you know, just for the good remembrance. Not to worship him, but just for the good remembrance. So, they would see the image and they would get inspired. That was at the beginning. And after that, what they said, one generation passed, the second generation came and said, no, no, let's worship this thing. See, from one generation to the second generation, from where to where? First, they just used it just as a remembrance to enhance them. And then this generation is gone, the second generation comes in, and they begin to worship. So, just in two generations, and they've gone to polytheism. So quickly, about 40, 50 years, and they're gone. So Islam said that this is then the avenue that will lead up there. When it's an avenue to lead up there, then this is also impermissible. So then Nabi Sam sounded the punishment, the consequence. أَشَدُّ النَّاسِ عَذَابًا يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. The worst punishment is for the photographer. Right? There's about four or five things that comes in the hadith that I remember. There may be more where the hadith says أَشَدُّ النَّاسِ, the worst punishment. Worst punishment is for who? مَنْ قَتَلَهُ نَبِيٌ أَوْ قَاتَلَهُ النَّبِيٌ مَنْ قَتَلَهُ نَبِيٌ أَوْ قَتَلَ نَبِيًا مَنْ قَتَلَهُ النَّبِيٌ أَوْ قَتَلَ نَبِيًا. If he killed a Nabi, or a Nabi killed him. If he killed a Nabi, or a Nabi had killed him, then the worst type of punishment is meted out to that person. Right. Secondly, that type of person who starts off an evil, like you got Qadianism, right? A whole polytheist movement, right? So, the one that starts it off, then he is going to be punished the worst way on the day of Qiyamah. And then in the same list is the photographer, Ashaddun Nasi Adaban, the worst punishment. The three punishments that come in the hadith, one is the hadith will say, Ahyu ma khalaqtum. See, you made this, now give it life. This is a photo, it's an image, so give it life. The second punishment that comes in is that he's asked to make a knot from a grain. You know, you've got a grain, can you make a knot in that? You can't, it's impossible, then impossible for your punishment to be stopped. Punishment will continue. The third punishment for that photographer is that he is deprived of the companionship of the malaika. The malaika, they make dua for you. They protect you. They beg Allah Ta'ala's mercy on your behalf. A Muslim, in his home, you'll find some sukoon. In a Muslim's home, you'll find sukoon, you'll find peace, you'll find comfort, calmness. Right? So, when these things are going on in that home, then the malaika get out of that home. When they get out of that home, now there's no sukoon, there's fighting in that home. There's trouble in that home. There's misunderstanding in that home. That home is never peaceful then. So, where he stopped idolatry, then he stopped those avenues that will lead ultimately to that idolatry. And I told you the reason why. Because there's no Nabi to come after Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam.
When there's no Nabi, now if a wrong sets in, now who's going to come and correct it? I ask, who's going to come and correct it? Nobody to come and correct it, so just stop the avenue also. But only the wrong, but the avenue that will ultimately lead to that wrong, that also must be stopped, finished. You see the dynamics of the Islamic fiqh and the Islamic procedures, so powerful, eh? That even those avenues are declared as impermissible, declared as haram, forbidden. Can't keep it. Now people may ask, what about money that you have, photograph as well? And what about passport and ID cards and all that? What about that? So in that respect, must understand that one is what you've been compelled to do. It's a government obligation, right? So there Allah Ta'ala will not hold you responsible. Why? It's an obligation. Ikrahu amru sultani ikrahum. When the leader, when the king, etc., when he commands, then that's force. And where you get the dalil from, you get the proof from this. Ibrahim alayhi salam is moving with his respected family, Hazrat Sarah radiallahu anha, right? And they're cutting through Egypt. Right? And it was a standard in Egypt that if any person is walking past, then the king will forcefully take away his wife. The king will forcefully take away his wife, right? And he did the same with Sarah radiallahu anha, until Sarah radiallahu anha had made dua. When she made dua, then the king got paralyzed from head to toe. Right? So she got saved in that way. But Ibrahim alayhi salam is not answerable for this. You will not say that he willingly gave away his wife, because it was the command of the king. And when it's a command of the king, then you got no say in the matter. What can you do? You're helpless, no? So if it's a king, it's a ruler, and they're commanding you to do something, then you got no say. Majbur or mazur. But apart from that, can you say that you are totally helpless? You can't say that you're helpless. Now, it becomes such a problem. A new child, a child has just come into this world, right? Already the curses are coming up. The child is there, and you are foretowing the child. Can you see the curses descending? Can you see the malaika moving away? Can you see the barakat and the blessings departing? Everything is going away. You taking the photo in the presence of a child, all the malaika, everything is going away, the blessings are running away. Where you want that blessing, you want that goodness, everything is going away. Or you got that photos in your album, right? Then again you are inviting the curse. See, there is a hadith which says, إِنَّ الْمَيِّتَ لَيُعَذَّبُ بِبُكَاءِ أَهْلِهِ عَلَيْهِ إِنَّ الْمَيِّتَ لَيُعَذَّبُ بِبُكَاءِ أَهْلِهِ عَلَيْهِ. That the mayyat, right? A mayyat, a dead person, is punished on account of people crying over it. But now how do you explain this hadith? That the mayyat is being punished on account of people crying over it. So there's two, three things that you have to understand in this hadith. One is, this hadith doesn't refer to general crying. Otherwise, Nabi Sallam himself had cried over his son's passing away. Innal aynani latadma'an. Right? So Nabi Sallam himself cried. So it's not normal crying. The crying that is referred to here is the wailing and shouting. Oh, my darling, you know, what must I do after you? And shouting. You're breaking your hair locks and tearing away your collars, scratching yourself, like how they do it in the ancient days, pagan days, paganism. Right? They're breaking the hair locks, right? Disheveling the hair, scratching their faces, tearing the collars and all that. So that's what it's being referred to, which is called noha. Right? So this type of wailing, this used to happen in the Arabs, right? Up till now you'll find it, sometimes you find. I remember I was in what's that famous hospital in town? Huh? No. No, the other one. St. Aidan's, yeah. No, that. Huh? Not, I think St. Aidan's, it was that private hospital, man. St. Aidan's. Augustine, I was in Augustine. You were by that ICU unit, you know. Whilst we were there, so someone just passed away. Now, all his family just came into the adjacent room, all like educated class, all you can see, all professional people. And they cried loudly now, holding hands, and they're crying and shouting and all that. Now, that is the thing that is impermissible. Shouting and crying and wailing and all that, that is the thing that is impermissible. Right? So it used to happen in the pagan days. Now, in the second zaman of paganism, was one jahalat then, one day, one zaman of ignorance then, now is the second zaman of ignorance. So that ignorance is not completely wiped out. Right? So Nabi Sam is referring to this type of crime. إِنَّ الْمَيِّتَ لَيُعَذَّبُ بِبُكَاءِ أَهْلِهِ عَلَيْهِ. Right. Now, the second question that comes up is, kare kon or bhukte kon? That person is crying and this person is getting punished. Who is crying? The family is crying and this person is being punished. What's the relationship? Why is it? So there's a lot of explanations, about 8-9 explanations to that. But I'm just giving you one explanation only. That is, for our consumption, just one explanation is enough, right? The reason for the mayyat being punished at that time is that the mayyat used to condone and used to like and consent this type of practice. He condoned it. He was silent, was a silent partner. He was approving of all these type of things. Or he made a bequest for the same. Okay, if I die, then do this for me as well. You know, the people think, hey, the person is deeply missed, you know. He's not something that was just like a furniture and we got him over or out of the road. No, they deeply miss him. So they must do it. So he's to make a bequest for that. The people must cry for him. Right? So now he's being punished. Why? Because he made a bequest for the same. Or he liked the same thing. He encouraged this. He condoned this. He consented this. So therefore he's being punished because of this practice here. Right? Now, how does it relate to photography? We talked about photography and I brought this hadith here. What's the link? Right. So I don't know recent times, but when we were in school, right, they should take group photos. You class one now, everyone, so line up, take photographs, right. Now it may be he's got my photograph, right. I'm condemning the practice, but he's got it. Right. So if I condemn it, right, then I won't be sinful. I say, see, I'm not responsible. You got it. I can't go and break into your home. But I'm asking you that my photograph is going to tear it off. But if I condone that, I approve of that as well. That means I'm a silent partner to this wrong. I want that to be preserved. I want to see it for memory's sake, whatever. So I want it to be preserved. So by extension of this analogy, إِنَّ الْمَيِّتَ لَيُعَذَّبُ بِبُكَاءِ أَهْلِي عَلَيْهِ. You will say that the same applies to this photography if you are condoning it, or you're silent about the whole thing. You're not condemning the practice. So like this person is going to be punished, you'll be punished as well. That at some level, you're condoning the practice, you're consenting it, you're approving of it, you're not against it in any way. You know, people keep his memories, you know. Or he was in sports, he was an outstanding performance, or he delivered a speech, or he came out first, and there is being award, giving that award, the teacher is giving him that award, whatever it is, and that is kept into the files. Sometimes, when people ask questions, then it annoys me, because they ask unrelated questions that are not related, unrelated. Now, they're asking, just yesterday that email came in, he's got mumps, so can he keep fast? Yeah, he can keep fast. So, what is the cure for it? No, that doesn't relate to me. That relates to a physician. Why? I'm not a doctor. So they ask stupid questions. It's not supposed to be. They're not supposed to be referring that question to me. Or there are some things that are not related. what was the name of Musa alayhi salam's mother? What was her name? But does it relate to you? How does it affect your life? Will they ask you in the Qabr about the same thing? The Akhirah, will they ask you about the same thing? You know, unrelated things. Oh, what was the length of the boat of Nuh alayhi salam? What was the length? But how does it relate to you? How does it affect your life? It doesn't relate. If it is relating to something halal, haram, you know, it will take you to Jannat, it will bring you closer to Allah Ta'ala. If it's worth the while, let me go and investigate the thing, I will tell you. But it doesn't relate to anything, then why should you ask this type of question? But the sad side of this type of questioning is that many of those people that ask these questions here, you ask them, "Bhai, you got any qaza umris?" "Yeah, a lot of qaza umris I got. Lot of qazas to do. Rosas, yeah, a lot of qazas." But you haven't finished that yet, and you're asking this type of secondary thing. Then the last is, "Wow, you get to the moon now, which side you must perform namaz?" But jo is waqt ka farz hai, usko to pura karo. You're talking about that farz when you go there. But this farz, what is immediate, you know, immediate. You haven't completed that, and you're dreaming over the moon. See, shaitan puts you into that. He puts you into asking things that are not related. Not related, not necessary. It's very unlikely to take place. You know, like for all of us, for any of us to reach the moon, it's very, very unlikely. I don't say it's impossible, but it's very unlikely that we'll go and reach the moon. But yes, that farz namaz that we left out, that definitely we will be asked for. That shaitan makes us forget that conveniently. He must go and make this tahqiq, research this, investigate this masla, a very important masla. That you get into the moon now, which side you must perform namaz. But ek saal ka qaza to reh gaya hai. Isko to pehle karo, usse nimat jao. And the estate is not sorted out yet. Sort your estate out, eating haram this side. Sometimes your roza is left out. Sometimes other farais you don't know. You're not practicing it or you don't know it. You have forgotten all that farais, and this conveniently you're asking these type of things that don't relate to you. So you ask about those things that are related. That's why Ibn Abbas says that the most intelligent group was the Sahaba Kiram. They didn't ask unnecessary questions. All in the Quran, it's only about 15 questions that they asked. In the Quran, yas'alunaka, yas'alunaka, 14, 15 places. Because their minds was, we asking because we need to practice. Not just for curiosity sake. And we asking for curiosity. Just to satisfy our curiosity. They were asking, you know, hey, is faraz, this is faraz or not faraz? We have to give charity now. Who must we give? يَسْأَلُونَكَ مَاذَا يُنْفِقُونَ now. We need to give charity. But who should we give our charities to? And how much should we give? Who should we give? And how much should we give? So that's a genuine question. That now, all right, I have to give the charity, but where must I give it? And how much must I give? Because I can give the whole wealth. Someone will say, now, I have to give charity, take out all his wealth, or give half of his wealth. So how much and where must I go and spend? So these type of questions are absolutely essential, they asked. But these type of things they didn't ask. So should we try and pretend to be more intelligent than Sahaba Kiram? Just don't become too smart. Don't become over intelligent. They asked one villager, you know, okay, we hear that your son is educated. He said, yeah, he's very educated now. He said, how educated he is? He said, now to, wo to khare khare mutta bhi hai. He's so educated that he can stand and urinate now. But the villager, these villagers, they hit you below the belt, you see. Somehow they will put you in your place. But they put you in your place correctly. See. What is supposed to say, be said, they will do it. See, in other words, now, when you get to that level of education, then you become an ignorant person. Then you act ignorant. Then you lose all your own home values, you know, home values, how you must conduct yourself, how you do go about doing things, what are the natural correct procedures. Forget that now. And you get into a different lifestyle altogether. And you think now it's in the name of education, I'm so educated, so advanced that I can do these type of things. Whereas it's a reflection of ignorance, misunderstanding. You don't have values in you. So what we're getting at is that when we started off this whole subject was muhabbat. And muhabbat, I say, sometimes is just one small little thing And the small little thing, then it progresses. One thing leads to the other, and the second, and the third. Eventually you come to the ultimate. You look at Hazrat Hamza radiallahu anhu's Islam, right? So he is the uncle of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, but he had a very, very deep love for Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Hadn't yet accepted Islam. In the meanwhile, Hazrat Hamza radiallahu anhu used to do a lot of hunting, right? He hasn't accepted Islam, but he has always got a very deep attachment for Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. He's gone for hunting, and as he returned, so his slave girl says to him, "You know, Abu Jahl, you know how he slandered your nephew, Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, what he said today. It's terrible. It was not at all behoving of him to say such words to Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam." So Hamza radiallahu anhu found out, is that the truth or not? Or she's making up a story. He found it's the right thing. He went and smashed him right in the haram. The haram came and nice smashed his head down, fractured his skull or something. Other people tried to come up, but Abu Jahl also had some level of justice. You know, I did overplay my part. I deserve that hiding. I did overplay my part. And then in that heat of the whole thing, he says, "You are hitting him. Whereas I also am a follower of Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam." Now that he just came out, it was in his emotions, he says, the love, then it will take you from one level to the other level. It started off at that point. Okay, the love of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and in that emotion he says that you are hitting him and I am a follower of him as well. Now he said these words here, now he can't retract because it is that as well. He came to the defense and he can't retract. So now he's, for a day or something, he's a little bit of in a ghabra state. What do I do? So he said, the best thing is, let me go to the Haram Sharif. Go to the Haram Sharif, and the whole night, 1-2 days, he resigned himself, Allah, you open my heart. Until after a day or so, Allah Pak opened his heart. Sharah Allahu sadrahu lil Islam. Allah Pak opened his heart. You accept Islam. So from that day, I never looked backwards. Then I never had any reservations. First, I just did it emotional. But then that became a reality. But you see where it starts from. It started from love, then it came to reality. So this love is a thing that we need to entertain, to buy. It's a priceless commodity. It's a very, very priceless commodity. Right? It's Sahaba Kiram, when they heard that hadith, Al-Mar'u Ma'aman Ahabba, a man will be grouped with the people that he loves. Right? They say that nothing brought us that level of satisfaction and happiness as this hadith. Because in our actions, we are doubtful whether we did the right level or not. You know, that amount of tahajjud, that type of sunnat namaz, faraz namaz, that type of charity, whatever. We may be doubtful about that. Right? But in respect to the love of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, we got no doubt about it. Ford blocking someone. NT 16859 NT. So this Mahabbat, you're talking of Mahabbat, right? The Sahaba Kiram said nothing brought us that satisfaction as this brought satisfaction to us, because we are absolutely certain about it. We are clear, we are sure. In our love for Nabi Sallam, we had no doubt. So, Allah Pak is telling us, don't worry, if you got that very good, strong level of love, then you'll be with us. You'll be with Nabi Sallam then. You may do this for us, sunnahs, etc., but then other nafals and all, you may not be at that level. Right? In spite of that, for the sake of that love that you have got, inshallah, you'll be grouped accordingly. So what we need to entertain and what we need to cultivate is this love. So there's a way to cultivate that love. Like I said, this brand clothing, right? Brand name clothing. Without the brand name, ask Mullah Muhammad Qadi, he will tell you, he's doing all his clothing, right? Same t-shirt, 50 rand. Exactly the same. But just with that brand name and 500 rand. So actually what he did, he cultivated a love for that name. When he cultivated a love for the name, that thing became so expensive in his eyes. So what we need to do is cultivate this love of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. You know, true love, not just a namesake, no, a true love for Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. A true love for the Sahaba Kiram. A true love for the Aimmah Mujtahideen. A true love for the Salafus Salihin. True, true love. And then you see what will happen. It will just bring about a revolution to your life. Allah Ta'ala.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yesterday we had stopped discussing at the point of Qoma, that upon rising up from ruku, one will come to the standing posture and you will remain with Ta'adil arkan, that is, you will remain with complete ease, you will not rush to proceed into sajda. So after a person stands with ease and with Ta'adil arkan, then you will say the takbir and go into the posture of sajda. And when saying the takbir, you would commence the takbir as soon as you start lowering your back, and you will only end of the takbir once you reach the ground in the posture of sajda. That it shouldn't be such that you start bending and only as you near the ground, then only you say Allahu Akbar, or you say Allahu Akbar and then you continue proceeding to the sajda. But as soon as you start lowering your back, you start the takbir and you say Allahu Akbar and you stretch it until you reach the posture of sajda. And when going down to the ground, you will allow your knees to first touch the ground. Then you would place your hands onto the ground, and then your nose and forehead will touch the ground. So in going down to sajda, so you would say it in this manner, we're saying the takbir from the standing posture, that you will say Allahu Akbar. And then in sajda, one should ensure that there is a gap between the stomach and the thighs. A person shouldn't crouch himself in sajda, but rather he should allow there some space between the stomach and the thighs. Then the hands would be, the palms would be placed parallel to the face, keeping the fingers tightly closed, facing towards the Qibla. The elbows will not be placed onto the ground, but rather they will be raised off the ground, and the arms will be kept away from the sides. But obviously when reading in Jamaat Salah, one should take note of those on the side, that no inconvenience at the cliff is caused to them. So one won't push out his hands as much as if he's reading alone without anybody on his sides. And then in sajda, you would join both the feet, and you would place the toes in such a manner that the toes will be placed against the ground facing the Qibla. And in sajda you would keep your gaze towards your nose. So the sajda will be made in this manner, that where there would be a gap between the stomach and the thigh, the feet would be kept together and the hands would be placed onto the ground. And then you would recite the Masnoon Tasbih in sajda, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la, thrice or any other odd number of times. And then you would get up to come into the posture of Jalsa. You say Allahu Akbar and come into the posture of Jalsa, which is the sitting position between both the sajdas. And again, you would sit with Ta'adil Arkan, that as soon as you come up from the first sajda, you will not rush to proceed to the second sajda, but you will allow for your body to come at ease. And in the Jalsa posture, you would sit with both hands on your thighs, with the fingertips at the edge of your knees. The fingers will be kept in a normal position. You won't keep them tightly closed, nor will they be spread apart, but rather in a normal position. And your gaze will be at a spot between your lower chest to your laps. So you will keep your gaze focused to that area of the body. And when sitting in the Jalsa posture, you would sit on your left foot, keeping your right foot erect, with the toes facing towards the Qibla. So you would be seated on your left foot, and the right foot will be kept erect, and the toes facing towards the Qibla. And then you would go into the sajda, for the second sajda, reciting the tasbihat thrice or any other odd number of times. And then you would say the takbir Allahu Akbar to get up for the second rakat. And in the same manner, you would get up, saying the takbir from the moment you raise your head off the ground, stretching it right till the time you come to the standing posture, that you won't just say Allahu Akbar and then continue rising, but you would stretch the takbir. So you would see Allahu Akbar in this manner from the sajda position, Allahu Akbar, till the time you come into the standing posture. And when getting up from the ground, you would first raise your face, then your hands, and then your knees. And if a person is fit, is healthy, then you will not take support from the ground when getting up from the sajda position, but rather you will just get up immediately. Yes, if a person has some health problem and he is unable to get up immediately, then he will be allowed to take support from the ground when getting up for the second rakat. Then after getting up for the second rakat, you would read the second rakat as normal. Then before Surah Fatiha, you will recite Bismillah. Then you recite Ameen upon the completion of Surah Fatiha. Recite the Surah. And then you will proceed to Ruku and complete the rakat as normal. Then upon the completion of the second sajda in the second rakat, you will then sit in the, come up for Qa'da. And you will recite At-Tahiyyat. And when reciting At-Tahiyyat and in the posture of Qa'da, you will sit in the same manner as you sat in Jalsa. That is with your palms, your hands kept on your thighs, your fingertips at the edge of the knees, and keeping your gaze at the area from your lower chest to your lap. And then you would sit on your left foot, keeping your right foot erect. And in the Qa'da, when you're reciting At-Tahiyyat, then upon coming to the place of the Shahadat, and saying Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, then when reaching Allah ilaha, then you would form a ring with the middle finger and the thumb of the right hand, together with raising the index finger, and at the same time, the remaining two fingers, the small finger and the ring finger, they would be closed in. So you would keep the hands as normal, but once you reach Ashhadu Allah, then at Allah ilaha, you would form a ring with the middle finger and the thumb of the right hand, together with raising the index finger, and upon saying Illallah, then you would lower the index finger. And it will be kept like this till the end of the salah. If this is a 3 or 4 rakat namaz, then upon the completion of the At-Tahiyyat, you would then say the takbir to come up for the 3rd and 4th rakat, and then you would complete the salah. And if this is the last qada, whether it is the last qada of a 2 rakat salah or a 3 rakat salah, etc., then upon the completion of the At-Tahiyyat, you would recite Durood Ibrahim, and after Durood Ibrahim, you would then recite any dua from the Quran or Hadith. The commonly recited dua is Allahumma inni zalamtu nafsi dhulman kathira. So upon the completion of this dua, then you would make salam first to the right, then to the left. And when making salam, you would turn your face to such an extent that a person behind would be able to see your cheek. And when making salam, you would focus your gaze to your shoulder, both on the right as well as on the left.